This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Everyone takes the ferry in Istanbul. It's how the city gets from one side to the other. But stay on board a little longer and you arrive at the Prince's Islands, a cluster of nine islands southeast of Istanbul in the Sea of Marmara. Once places of exile for royals, today they're something else entirely. And on the island of Büyükada, local businesswoman Mina Akdar and her family have been enjoying the unique pace of life here for generations.
Büyükada is a place where time stands still. And as soon as you step onto the island, you feel at peace and you feel relaxed. Walking around, exploring different beaches, I think it's just wonderful for anyone who's interested in beautiful places.
Just an hour from the hustle and bustle of the city, yet a world away, the Prince's Islands are a place where doing less somehow feels like more. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
At the end of July, like something out of I, Claudius, the President of the Republic of Niger was deposed by the leader of the Presidential Guard. President Mohamed Bazoum, elected in 2021, was ousted by Abdurrahman Tchiani in a country recently seen as something of a beacon of democracy in a chronically unstable region. This week, as the military junta named a new government, the leaders of a regional union known as ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, met to discuss what to do about the situation in Niger. Their dilemma is whether or not to intervene directly to restore the legitimate president. But how much should we in the rest of the world worry about it? Isn't it just another coup in a far-off country we know little or nothing about? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a geography and recent history primer. Paul Melly is a journalist and consulting fellow with the Africa programme at Chatham House. Paul Melly, let's start with the geography and demography. For those that don't know, in the first instance, where is Niger?
Niger is sitting in the Sahel, which is the band of fairly arid terrain that stretches right across West Africa from the Atlantic Ocean, I mean, geographically, right through to the Red Sea. But in general, when people talk about the Sahel, what they really mean is that band from sort of Mauritania, then you have Mali, Burkina Faso, then comes Niger, and then Chad. So the northern half of the country is essentially the Sahara Desert, and the southern half is a strand of land which has a pretty arid climate, just rains 2 or 3 months of the year from sort of late June through to early September. And what's grown then is what has to sustain the population for the rest of the year. So it's in a very fragile position geographically and climatically.
Is it landlocked?
It's landlocked. It lies directly north of Nigeria and Benin. And that plays into the current political crisis because as sanctions are put on by other West African countries, Niger has to go through them to export its trade to the outside world.
So, scrub, farmland, very dry, extreme climate. Tell us a bit about the population.
The population of Niger is best estimated, if you like, at somewhere around 25 to 27 million. Niger has one of the highest rates of population growth in the world. The average woman perhaps having 6-7 children, according to UN figures. Population growth is slowing slightly, family size is slowly reducing, but that's a very, very gradual trend. So The population may well double by the late 2030s or 2040s. And although development progress has been significant, you know, quite a few people go to school. The majority of kids go to primary school. A significant proportion now go on to secondary school, including girls. Still, there are huge, huge challenges. And it is very often the country that rates bottom of the UN Human Development Index, officially the poorest country in the world.
What about industry and natural resources?
Niger has one sort of headline natural resource which everybody talks about, which are its uranium reserves. The uranium provides something like 15 or 20% of the supply for the French nuclear power industry. So that's obviously a major strategic asset. There is some gold. Otherwise, it's not really a mining economy. So it's not like the countries of Central Africa, you know, producing large quantities of copper or whatever.
Okay, let's look at the history of Niger. Obviously, a French colony, what, dating from the scramble for Africa at the end of the 19th century?
Yeah, so essentially in that sort of carve-up of them between the European powers to try and secure assets all over the African continent with the famous Berlin Conference where people literally drew lines on a map, the French basically took over control of the whole of the Sahel, pretty much, and chunks of coastal West Africa. And Niger was part of what was called French West Africa. But what's really important to remember is that this is a country that had a much deeper, older history. Right across West Africa, there were empires, sultanates, dating right back to the medieval era, same sort of period as in Europe. And they included large parts of what is now Niger in their territory. And then French colonial rule, in fact, if you take that really long perspective, it only lasted from around 1900 till independence in 1960. So that's not really a very long period in the scope of history.
So Niger, having been a French colony, becomes independent in 1960, as you say. More recently, what's the history of Niger been?
Like many former colonies in Africa, both former French colonies and former British colonies, the original political system set up at independence didn't last very long, was soon replaced by authoritarian military rule. But then in around 1990, essentially, people in West Africa were influenced by the end of the Cold War, not just that there was no longer a sort of Soviet Union versus West rivalry in the continent, but they could see people power happening in Eastern Europe. And across French-speaking Western and Central Africa, there was a wave of massive people power protests and almost popular revolutions, if you like. And Niger was caught up in that. And the situation was resolved through what was a national conference where all sorts of interest groups, including the old regime, all the political groups, other interests, came together to discuss a way forward and agreed, essentially, the framework for a multi-party democratic political system. And the political parties we have now, they are essentially the ones that were created at the start. So the MNSD, the new juntas named a prime minister from this party, the MNSD, which was born, set up by the military as they sort of were forced to hand over power. Former President Bazoum, or President Bazoum, who's currently being detained, his party, the PNDS, was set up in that period as a sort of essentially occupying, if you like, the social democratic space on the political spectrum, whereas the MNSD was more associated with the army, so a bit more to the right. And those parties dominated the electoral politics and party politics through most of the last 30 years or so. There have been a couple of coups, so there was one interlude of military rule that was very authoritarian. Then later on, there was a democracy coup because one president had tried to sort of dismantle democratic safeguards. So the army stepped in, but very briefly. But apart from those two periods, so 4 years in all, since about 1991, Niger has operated a multi-party political system.
Right. And so the present president, the one still recognised by the West as president, he was elected.
Yes, that's right. Bazoum was elected in the second round of that election in early 2021 and then took office a few weeks later. Achieved a pretty strong mandate. He was elected with about 56% of the vote. Interestingly, is from a small Arab tribe a very much a minority group, but both from his personal qualities, but also because his party has a strong national network, a strong national political machine, he was able to achieve a pretty convincing victory in an election that most international observers think was pretty credible and pretty fair.
Paul Melly, what's it like being a witness to a coup? Garay Amadou is a journalist and manager of the newspaper Le Canard Déchaîné. He lives in Niger's capital, Niamey. Mr. Amadou, what's the reaction been within Niger to the coup?
The reaction, we have two kinds of reaction in Niger. We have the first reaction is coming from supporters of the junta, and most of them are located in Niamey, the capital. And we have in the other side, those who supported the President Bazoum regime, most of them in the 8 other regions of Niger.
And these people who don't like what's happened with the coup, what have they been doing? Have they been protesting?
Yeah, the day after the coup, they protested in the capital, Niamey. So there was a huge demonstration in front of the Niger parliament, and they tried to go to the presidential palace, but they had security forces in front of them. So the demonstration ended at that time. In the region, we have a huge demonstration of support to Mohamed Bazoum. But most of the demonstrations that were planned to take place, demonstration organized by Mohamed Bazoum supporters, the junta decided to refuse to allow people to express their continue to support President Mohamed Bazoum. So currently, we can say that a demonstration to support Mohamed Bazoum is not allowed in the country.
As an independent journalist, do you feel at all frightened?
To make it clear, since the beginning of the events, I cannot move freely from my home to another place in the capital. I have to be careful because of the civilian checkpoints. They can decide maybe to attack the people. So it is very dangerous. I'm very frightened because the situation is getting worse and worse.
We've read some reports of some people waving Russian flags. Is that true?
It's true because I have some pictures of people waving Russian flags. What does it mean? Niger is facing a kind of very difficult security situation. In the east, we have the actions of Boko Haram, a terrorist group, and ISWAP also. And also in the west of the country, we have Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, terrifying people in the country. So Niger people, they see that French cannot fight really against terrorists. Wagner group is very strong and it can do what it was doing. Because of fake news they're having from Mali, saying that, yeah, in Mali, situation is getting better and better. But if you analyze what is happening in Mali, you can see that Wagner didn't do anything to make situation change because most of the territories I'm talking about Mali are occupied by terrorists.
So they've been waving Russian flags because they wrongly believe that the Russians will help in the fight against the terrorists. Is there still a big presence for France in Niger?
French authority here in Niger is getting very bad because the fact that Russian flags are waved by people is not really something that makes French fear. But yesterday or 2 days before, we have a Malian delegation that came in Niger. And according to information I got, some members of Wagner are on the delegation. So I think that the French government got this information and they know that unfortunately, it seems that the junta is going to sign a kind of agreement with Wagner group in order maybe to protect the presidential palace. It happens in Central Africa and in Mali.
This is a very difficult question for you to answer, Garay, but what do you think is going to happen?
I think that what will happen is that the fact that ECOWAS members are angry about the junta, the fact that it refused to meet delegations here, maybe we are going to a very, let's say, bad development of the situation. I'm talking about the intervention of ECOWAS forces, and maybe they will be helped by NATO forces or United States forces. So the situation in Niamey will be very dangerous.
Garay Amadou, just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about examining the threat posed to the UK by China, the one about whether we can meet the net zero challenge, and the one about what schools can do about record absences. So, now we know a bit more about Niger and about how the current crisis began. Finally, I want to find out what this means for the future of the country, the surrounding region, and for the rest of us. Joining me in the briefing room now are Nabila Ramdani, French-Algerian journalist and author of an upcoming book, Fixing France, How to Repair a Broken Republic, and Olayinka Ajala, senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Leeds Beckett University. Olayinka Ajala, if I can start with you, there might be some people listening to this programme who are thinking to themselves, why should I be worried about what's happening in Niger? Can you tell us why Niger might matter to the West?
I think there are about three main reasons why Niger matters. The first one is because of the geographical location. Niger sits right at the center of the Sahel and shares border with seven other African countries. In the last couple of years, especially in 2015, 2016, we saw what happened with the large numbers of illegal immigrants, coming to Europe through the Mediterranean, many of them losing their lives. So Niger, because of their strategic location, the country was a major hub for illegal immigration across the Sahel through Libya into Europe. But what's happened was about 12 years ago when Niger returned to democracy, the country has been a very good ally to the West because they've signed bilateral and multilateral agreements with the EU and some other countries to curb illegal migration through the country. And this has worked really well. We've seen numbers coming down over the years. So that's the first point. The second one is Niger is a partner to France, the US, and also to other African countries to combat terrorism and also to combat trafficking, illegal trafficking, human trafficking, drug and weapon trafficking. So that's another reason Niger has been partnering with other countries to work on these issues and to reduce these menaces. And then the third one is also because of the broader security architecture of the Sahel. So the US, they have one of their biggest drone bases outside of America in Niger, in Agadez. So they provide surveillance, flight, whereby they gather information and then feed back to their partners in the fight against insurgency and terrorism in the region. So when we look at those three factors, we will understand that it's important, Niger is strategically important to the West.
Nabila Ramdani, can I come to you and ask you about the region more generally? Why is the Sahel region apparently so prone to unrest, so much so that Niger had come to be seen as this, if you like, this kind of big place where you could reside your hopes for stability?
Well, the Sahel is an absolutely enormous area of sub-Saharan Africa. It straddles around a dozen countries, from Eritrea to Senegal via Niger, and it's an area that has been largely lawless for centuries. Centuries-old trade routes once associated with nefarious activities, including slavery, have become conduits for newer types of criminal commerce, such as the trafficking of arms, drugs, and contraband. And it is so big that it is very hard to police, if not impossible. And so criminal groups, and increasingly terrorist ones, use it to set up their bases and to attack sovereign countries within the region. The lack of jobs, basic social services, and effective state institutions within the Sahel have, in fact, drawn more and more locals into the criminal economy and, indeed, into insurgent activity.
Can you tell us a little bit about its relationship with France? Because, like a lot of the other countries here, this was a former French colony. Has the French colonial experience actually contributed anything to the degree of instability in the region?
Well, very much so, David. It's 63 years since Niger officially gained independence from France. So you'd think that France would be free of all involvement in what's going on right now, but that's by no means the case. And despite the illusion of complete withdrawal, France has a garrison of 1,500 troops in Niger, together with an air force base servicing fighter jets and attack drones, for example. And all of this is a forceful reminder that in spite of a long and bloody period of decolonization, France has in fact retained a quasi-empire in Africa by stealth, and it is under threat like never before. And so the current crisis in Niger can be linked to former colonial relationships being restructured as what's known as France-Afrique, meaning a formidable neo-colonial nexus across sub-Saharan Africa, encompassing economic, political, security, and cultural ties and alliances centered on the French language and French values.
Olayinka, in March this year, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Niger a model of democracy. Was this more a statement made in hope than expectation, or was it genuinely believed at that point that Niger was stable?
I think it's a combination of hope and expectation. And when he made that statement, I shared that feelings as well, because I was at the end of writing an article where I used the case study of Nigeria and Niger as beacons of hope to democracy in the region. So I did a comparative analysis, and unfortunately, I didn't publish the article. It was a journal article when this happened. So yes, it's a combination of hope and expectation. Niger returned to democracy in 2011, and President Issoufou, the former President Issoufou, did an excellent job of holding down democracy for 10 years, the first time in the history of Niger, and also transitioning to another democratically elected government of President Bazoum. So that, again, was a first in the history of Niger. So it was becoming more stable. Lots of people in the country were already embracing, and many are still embracing democracy until this happened. So many people didn't see it coming, but the problem is the issue of fragility of this region, especially of Francophone Africa, as Nabila just highlighted. These issues have not disappeared. When you compare Francophone Africa with Anglophone Africa, you would see that most of the least developed countries in the world are in Francophone Africa. Many of these countries, they've seen the large numbers of military troops and military bases without a corresponding economic development. This poses a serious challenge to the region, not just to Niger, but the region.
Nabila, we know that ECOWAS are meeting today in Abuja, Nigeria, to discuss the political situation in Niger. Could you just explain to us what ECOWAS is and what the significance of such a meeting is?
ECOWAS is the Economic Community of West African States, a regional political and economic union of 15 countries, all located in West Africa. Now, the main significance of this meeting should be that all these African states are showing a strong united front, but the reality is that they are failing to do this. They are very used to organizing emergency summits, but they're certainly not coming up with effective solutions to their mounting problems. And what's very clear in this particular case is that there is no united military front. These states do not want to go to war over a coup in Niger. On the contrary, they fear that any military intervention could embolden other radical forces across the region and that even more insurrections would break out.
Olayinka, could you tell us just a little bit about the man who is now in charge in Niger? We're used to the heads of armies taking over, but this is just the head of the presidential guard. Who is he, and what do you think has motivated his move?
Right. So Abdurrahman Tchiani is, or was, I think I can use was now because he's the de facto ruler. He was the head of the presidential guard. The presidential guard in Niger is something you can liken to like special forces. So they belong to an elite arm of the military, very sophisticated, very well equipped, well armed. They provide security to the presidency and to other major infrastructures in the country. So Abdurrahman Tchiani, I think he's been the head of this organization since 2011. He was directly working with the presidency. He worked with President Issoufou, and when President Issoufou was president, and he's been working with President Bazoum. So there are rumors that there was an impending restructuring of the military. And that was one of the reasons why he moved to carry out this coup d'etat. Because when you look at what happened at that time, for almost 48 hours, the military were quiet. It was the presidential guard led by Tiani that led this coup. So it took a while before the military came on board and then said, yes, we agree to be part of this. So that still tells us it wasn't as planned as been discussed in some quarters. Interestingly, before Bazoum was inaugurated, about 48 hours before the inauguration of President Bazoum, there was a coup attempt, and it was this same General Tiani that fought off the attackers in order to preserve democracy at that time. So it is interesting that he is the one who now is leading this junta and who is the de facto leader at the moment.
Nabila, you'll have been watching other people, other countries' reaction to this. What have you noted about America's response to the coup in Niger, and what do you estimate they will be aiming to do?
Well, senior United States diplomats have visited Niger to push coup authorities to restore democratic rule after the overthrow of President Bazoum, but they evidently haven't been very successful. Victoria Nuland, who's the US acting deputy secretary of state, said on Monday that she held what she called frank and difficult talks with military leader Moussa Salah-Oumarou and three of his colonels in Niger, in the capital, Niamey. It was the first trip by a U.S. official to the country since the coup on July the 26th. Admittedly, I mean, Newland's request to meet with Bazoum and Abdourahman Tchiani, the self-proclaimed head of the military government, were denied. She reported about the briefing afterwards with reporters, and she offered, dare I say, a grim assessment of her talks with the military leaders, saying that they are quite firm in their view of how they want to proceed, and that doesn't comport with the constitution of Niger. So she quite frankly highlighted that it was a difficult day. And she, however, reaffirmed that the US would be committed to a negotiated solution to the conflict. If the coup leaders were willing to return to Niger's constitutional order, then the America would be prepared to help with that. But frankly, I'm a bit skeptical about that happening.
Okay, I think we need to try and push this forward. And I think the first question, Nabila, is, can we anticipate that in Niger, as in some of the other countries, we'll see a significant expansion of Russian influence via the Wagner Group?
Well, the Wagner troops are certainly stationed in nearby Mali, but there is no evidence of them being in Niger itself yet. And coup leaders in Niger have certainly called for help from Russia's Wagner mercenaries after neighboring countries threatened military intervention if the country's ousted president was not restored by Sunday. General Salifu Modi, one of the Nigerian officers leading the coup, made the request on a visit to neighboring Mali. So what we're effectively seeing in Niger being played out is another Cold War by proxy. You've got the old colonial powers being ousted, while new regimes, including Russia, China, and indeed Turkey, closing in on the region.
Olenka, if I could just ask you this. There's a recent UN report, actually this July, said that there was a significant level of popular support for recent military coups. And this was symptomatic of a wave of feeling that was expanding across the continent. How much do you think we should worry about that?
Yeah, we should worry about that because when you look at ECOWAS, ECOWAS has had 15 democracies at some point. It's composed of 15 countries. Four of these have fallen into the hand of the military. And that is why the organization is afraid. The leaders are afraid. And the question is, if we don't take a firm position, we don't know what country is next.
Layinka Ajala there with Nabila Ramdani. My thanks to them and to Paul Melly and Garay Amadou. And my conclusion on the question of does Niger matter? As small boats cross the channel and larger ones sink in the Mediterranean, John Donne's words resonate. These bells also toll for us. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Alex Pickles and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Penny Murphy and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I saw a footprint.
I'm Andrew Benfield and I'm obsessed with the Yeti.
The fist looks like some kinds of monkey.
The idea of a Yeti-like creature has been around for centuries, but could it be real? In Yeti, a new 10-part series from BBC Radio 4, I'm going to try to find out. I'll be joined by a good friend.
You said we were going for a short walk across the valley.
I'm Richard Horsey. This search isn't going to be easy.
They have the ability to disappear.
Are we chasing phantoms?
Yeti chasers will never find them.
But in this series, we think we might. Listen to Yeti on BBC Sounds.
What's there? What's there?
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.